The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So there are some times when I think of the Dhamma teachers who write out their talks beforehand and have the little table in front and read it out and put a little bit in here and there, and I was just thinking, God, it's kind of, sometimes that'd be quite nice to be able to do that. but in the way that I've been trained and that I continue in our practice as in sharing the Dhamma is to speak from the moment and from the heart, and you know, it can be an act of faith. One doesn't always know exactly what's going to come out. So today I could feel it's going to be one of those evenings where I'm not really sure what I'm going to speak about. And maybe it'll come in the meditation. Maybe during the meditation it'll become clear. So during the meditation, quite a number of different things are going through my mind. And then I asked Jill, what should I talk about tonight? She wasn't very helpful. I think what really is strongest for me at the moment is the vulnerability or the tenderness, you could say, of being a human being. And while we were doing the chanting, the first part of the chanting where we're recollecting the Buddha, even I've done this chant for years, when I'm chanting, particularly the morning chanting, it's got a little bit slightly different wording, and I have this sense of the Buddha, you know, actually as a person, as a human being, who, when the phrase that comes to mind was washed by all waters, you know, he went through so much, and both before his enlightenment and after. And, you know, this sense of, I feel this sense of devotion as I chant to this man, you know, this human being who, in the human realm that we are all in this sensitive human realm that we all live in, found the path that leads to the ending of suffering. And the key to the path, doesn't quite work, but the entrance to that path being in a turning towards suffering or turning towards dukkha. And perhaps living in a monastic situation, we hear from, you know, we meet many different people and we can hear from many different people the troubles of you know, just of an ordinary human life. And you know, it really hits home the vulnerability of being a human being, the sensitivity and vulnerability of being a human being. So the Buddha's encouraging us to look at the way we create suffering for ourselves, you know, the way we, through really being at odds with the way things are, not really being with things as they are. And you know, I'm sure for a fully enlightened Buddha, he's not experiencing the sense of vulnerability or trembling, you know, speak about the unshakable deliverance of the heart. This is one of a very beautiful expression. So an enlightened one, the heart is unshakable. There's no more trembling of the heart. But for those of us who aren't enlightened, there's quite a bit of trembling goes on. It can be falling in love, it can be beautiful, exciting, wonderful. And it can be fear, it can be frightening, it can be afraid of what's going to happen, it can be doubt, not sure how to make the right choice, big life changes. It can be grief, a sense of loss, being separated from our loved ones. You know, the heart is constantly, it seems, reverberating and trembling and responding to what life brings. And when we're with that, you know, it can be very challenging. It can feel like it would be much nicer just not to have to feel sometimes. Just to be able to kind of maybe rise up into the intellect and not pay attention to anything that's going on below the neck. I think people do that. But our human experience, it's a sensitive one. And in, you know, it's what we share that. We are all, I say, brothers and sisters in our in hope and in loss and in birth and in death. You know, we're all brothers and sisters. It's what levels us, regardless of our position in society or in our bank account or whatever it might be that we see. As what makes a status, you know, we all share the same vulnerability as human beings, and it's kind of inevitable. You know, once we're born, it is inevitable that we will go through gain and loss. You know, we'll get things that we want and we'll lose what we want. We'll lose what we love. Or we'll want what someone else has got. You know, we want what we can't have or isn't here with us. It's kind of inevitable that we go through those things. And as the body ages, you know, experience pain, physical pain and loss of maybe beauty. And then the mind, the brain, as we get older, we get a loss of the faculties for some. Lots of few people keep them right to the end. But, you know, most of us lose a few brain cells along the way. And eventually the body dies. We have to leave it all behind. Whatever we've accumulated, whatever we've accomplished, you know, we have to leave it all behind. So this is, you know, we meet in that place. It's a place that we don't often consciously meet in, because it's not a place that society encourages us to look at. But it is, you know, where we all meet. And you know, when I feel that, you know, there's a sense of the word tenderness, a sense of tenderness. You know, we can meet that with aversion, feeling, you know, it's wrong or we don't want it or why does it have to happen to me? But, you know, these things happen to everyone. They're part of this human experience. It's part of a deal, you could say. So, you know, I value more and more greatly the ability to stay open and present with whatever feelings are arising here in this body-mind. So there was a time when I first started to practice, I wanted to get away from the painful feelings I was experiencing as being a separate human being. It was a very, very painful experience. Very, very strong sense of a separate self. And the Buddha's teaching was promising me a way out of that. So at that time, you know, my understanding, my limited understanding was that I could get away from basically being sentient, feeling. And that probably there was some motivation, a little bit of confusion there in going into monastic life, thinking, you know, there in a monastic situation I can avoid painful feeling. Probably wasn't very conscious, but it was definitely there. And of course, being in a monastery does not equal avoiding painful feeling at all. So, first of all, it would be with people, interactions, you know. You'd kind of hope that the interactions would be nice, compassionate, and understanding, and we'd all be on the same wavelength. Then you find that that's not the case. Everybody's in their little world. We're all in our little worlds. It's amazing that we can function at all, actually. We each have our own world going on, our own experience going on. And those worlds sometimes meet and they sometimes bump into each other. They sometimes miss each other altogether. And that's just kind of how it is. And then, of course, physical suffering, one can't avoid. Physical pain and maybe also hunger, only being able to eat in the morning. And thirst sometimes, and fatigue, having to work hard. Now these are just, it took me a while to realize that this wasn't, you know, these weren't things that I was going to be able to get away from. This is just part of being human. And then there was the trying to end my attachments to people. So trying to break the attachments I had to people. And I had some quite strong ones. I came in with some very strong attachments. And spending some time trying to do that, you know, through contemplating death. I use death as a contemplation a lot. And my own death and the death of those I love. And also a asubha practice, you know, focusing on the organs and the sinews and the muscles and the skin and the hair and all the things that make up the body. So I was thinking about someone I was very attracted to, then I would go through these contemplations on my own body and the body of that person. And my motivation was to cut the attachments, sever the attachments. And it took me some time, maybe a few years, to realize that you can't do that. You can't sever attachments through your will. It doesn't work. And actually the Buddha's path and teaching is asking us to meet our experience in a much more subtle and open way. So, you know, there is the purpose really of the practice is to develop compassion and wisdom. And yet it's very easy to meet the practice from a place of that isn't compassionate or wise, you know, that's actually trying to get something or get rid of something or move on. Or become a great meditator, or become a stream enter, or become enlightened. And then we maybe start the practice in that way, meet the practice in that way, and then we find we keep kind of stumbling over ourselves, we stumble over our karma, and again, kind of brought to our knees, you know, in our very ordinary humanity. So it seems to me that the Buddha is asking us to look much more subtly and carefully at our experience and to use those wings of wisdom and compassion to look, to pay attention to what's going on here. And with, you know, you could think of those wings or as hands that can hold experience. So if you have with those two aspects of compassion and wisdom, you know, we can be with pretty much anything that's going on. Pretty much anything. So if we have a strong wisdom aspect that is very focused on impermanence, for example, you know, wisdom is that which you know, sees clearly the way things are. So recognizing the impermanence of all things, knowing the impermanence of all things, the state of flux that everything is in. You know, this is a liberating aspect, but without compassion, it can become cold and almost inhuman. I've witnessed that in even quite experienced, you know, very experienced practitioners, that taking kind of a side on wisdom, even it's very profound, and when it's not held hand in hand with compassion, it becomes heartless, becomes cold, and even harmful. And then, so you know, we need the element of compassion, the warmth, the resonance of compassion, within which to hold the teaching. And you know, one of the aspects of compassion, or one of the ways it can be translated, is to that the heart shakes with or is moved by what is happening. So is responsive to what is happening. So the wisdom is that which is unmoved, and the compassion is that which is moved, and they belong together. It kind of sounds like a paradox. It sounds like it's not possible for them both to be present, when one is present with, when one brings wisdom to the experience that's happening here in our body mind, you know, we can be with it, we can know it, we can see the change that's going on, and then the compassion is like the warmth of understanding, the kindness, the patience, the forgiveness, you know, the acceptance of the shaking heart. And the wisdom knows that it's changing, so it doesn't have to hold on and become what's going on. It doesn't have to become the doubt or the fear or the grief or the wanting. It's knowing that. It's knowing it. And the compassion is kind of holding it. So it's not trying to get this over and done with to get on to the next thing, but it's interested, it's kind, it's present, it's holding. So if we can, you know, develop these qualities in our practice, then there are no obstacles to the path. Then whatever, you know, life is bringing, whatever we're meeting in life, is the path, is our teacher. There are no hurdles to get over or obstacles to move out of the way, but they are the very path itself. They are what teaches us. And our impatience to get onto the next thing, you know, that becomes like a hurdle. And then we kind of trip over that. And then when we remember and come back again, we recognize, okay, that's the feeling of impatience. And then that becomes the teacher again. So it's very it is a very humble path. And it is bringing us back again and again to this experience, as it is. So compassion and wisdom, they need to be developed. If we were fully equipped with compassion and wisdom, we wouldn't need to be practicing. We would just be in a state of compassion and wisdom. We'd be free. It'd be great. But you know, until we are free, we need to work on those qualities. So you know, wisdom, you can find wisdom in many places. You know, it doesn't necessarily equate with intellect or IQ. You know, it can do, but it can also, you can have very, very wise, uneducated, simple people. So wisdom is a quality of understanding, of knowing, of direct knowing here and now. And it's very simple. If one can uncomplicate the mind enough to bring it into presence with what is happening here and now. And the tools, just like the sharpening tools for wisdom, are contemplating the ever-changing nature of things, or noticing, not just contemplating, but noticing the ever-changing nature of everything, all the time, at every moment. So, you know, somebody was saying the other day that they were afraid to let go of their kilesas, like their defilements, their obscurations of mind, like greed and hatred and delusion. They're afraid to let go of that, because if they let go of that, who would they be? Who would I be without greed, hatred, and delusion? You know, and then I'd be nothing, and that would be really scary. But actually, what the point is that we're a process. What we take to be ourselves is a process, and our life is a process. So we can be a process with greed, hatred, and delusion, which leads to suffering, which is also a process. Or we can be a process without greed, hatred, and delusion, which is simply a process. It simply is what it is. It is a process going through what it's going through at this moment. And there's a great freedom in that. So, you know, so wisdom, you know, is asking us to look at this constant changing nature of things. Look at the way we fix and hold and create things where there are no things, and to let go and allow this process to continue. You know, the suffering, also dukkha, is also a door to that, or an invitation to do that. It's much less likely for us to do that when everything's going great. But when things are getting difficult, you know, it's like an invitation, it's a reminder, hey, have a look, you know. Is this really me? Is this really solid? Is this really permanent? Or is this changing? And you can feel it. If you come into presence, you can feel the flux. Can feel the flux of pretty much anything. So this isn't to dismiss our experience. So this is one of the things that, you know, when we speak about impermanence, people sometimes think, oh well, if everything's impermanent, it doesn't matter. So that's just sort of, that doesn't matter, you know, it's just changing. But it, as I understand it, you know, the wisdom and compassion are not saying it doesn't matter, they're saying, look at this. Look at what's going on here. Come and have a look at this. It's paying really close attention. It's being really interested in this ever-changing process of all of it. All of it. So the impermanence is our most profound teacher. It's not something to be dismissed. And compassion is, you know, that which can hold the confusion, the sorrow, the loss, the wanting, the not wanting, the aging, the sickness, you know, all of that. Compassion is that which can hold all of that, the brokenness, the yearning for wholeness, all of that. It's like, it's not impatient, it's not judgmental. It's what the judgmental thoughts can be held within. It doesn't judge the judging mind. So compassion, you know, is like the holding. So I've always very, very much appreciated that the Buddha's teaching is, you know, it holds this paradox of emptiness and love, you could call it. It holds both. Doesn't take sides on one or the other, and it's a very difficult place to find within ourselves. It's not easy to find that place where there is both understanding of the emptiness of all things and the constant changing nature of all things, and have compassion for ourselves and others. Because then, you know, the rational mind wants to take a position and say, "Well, there is no self." So what is there to be compassionate about? There's no self. Or the compassionate mind or heart might say, "Oh, well, you know, it's we have to just really take care of every individual, every being, and not hold the bigger context of, you know, in some ways this is, well, let's say to protect others from suffering is impossible, let's put it that way. We can't protect others from experiencing suffering. So, you know, the compassionate heart wants to take care of and end and ease the suffering of others, and we can do that to some degree. But even the Buddha, the fully enlightened one, couldn't take away the suffering of others. He could only point to, actually pointing back to the suffering as the door to the ending of suffering. So it's, you know, we have to find that place within ourselves where they are both present, the understanding, the presence with this constant change, and the compassion for being a sentient being, which is a challenge. It's a challenge being human. And a very important part of this is to allow ourselves to feeling what's going on. So we have all kinds of amazing tricks to avoid feeling. And we can be very clever and rationalize and have very complicated reasons why we can't, why we're doing what we're doing, and often it's just a means to distract ourselves from being with what's going on here, to not feel deeply into what's going on here. So if we can develop the awareness, the strength of mind to be with feeling of this body mind as it is, whatever is going on. You know, this leads us into the Dhamma, you could say. This is the place where we're no longer creating ourselves or trying to get rid of, but we're with this feeling as it is. It's like this, and it's changing, and it's not who and what I am. It is this. It's simply this. So, you know, this is what I'm saying can't really be understood through the intellect so well. It's just an experiential teaching. And through coming into presence with this sensitive experience of being a human being, you know, this is it opens the door to the ending of suffering. And it's kind of counterintuitive, because we tend to think, you know, when I come here, I feel all that stuff, I feel all that vulnerability or that doubt or that grief or the longing, and so I have to do something that moves away from that. But actually we have to move deeper into it with greater presence, and we find when we do that that it opens up, and it becomes a teacher that leads us to freedom from suffering. So I'm going to end my talk there so that I don't go around again. And so I'd just like to end there, Ilwan. And I'd like to just open up if anyone has any questions, because I haven't gone into great detail, but if anyone has any questions about the actual practice of what I'm saying, or if what I'm saying makes sense or doesn't make sense, and maybe it doesn't make sense to you, I don't know. So please, it's helpful for me if you share a little bit of your experience or ask. Also, if you have any questions about what I'm saying. And I just also want to just add that, you know, one can practice for a long time without really honestly going into the experience of being human, dare I say it. So, you know, I know people who've been practicing a long time, done long retreats, very dedicated to the practice, but there's still a sense of embarrassment or awkwardness about really being with what's going on, really being fully human, you know, with the, because it is a kind of a, being human, it is a kind of an embarrassing predicament in some ways. It can be. So this is why this comes out tonight. I think maybe there's been a few. Anyway, don't mean to get over. So I'd like to just open the floor if you have any questions about the application of this or what I mean or more clarification.
I really appreciated your linking of wisdom and compassion. That's something that I've looked at in my own practice, being one who's had to work with being embarrassed at being human.
It is embarrassing.
And I, sort of the natural response of a mind that understands emptiness is actually to come back in the world and act with compassion. And then I can also see it the other way, in that the deepest compassion would include the desire to end the suffering of the feeling of the separate self. So maybe the deepest mm-hmm. compassion is to walk a path of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So I really like the way they intertwine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're set up as, you know, they balance each other, and you said mm-hmm. a little bit of that, but mm-hmm. I like the idea that they also enhance each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely. I think it can be that one develops one side. Perhaps it's not fully developed, you know, like one can develop like a wisdom aspect and lose compassion. Like I've witnessed that, but probably as one continues to develop the wisdom aspect, then it comes around again. Yeah. And also with compassion, you know, with compassion it can be a really wanting to end suffering without actually really understanding that, you know, the nature of samsara, and then there's just like a, you get compassion burnout and so on. You know. So it can, just to say that can also happen. But I think as you say, as they develop, then they become two sides of one thing. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So the question, I can just repeat the question. The question is, how does one turn towards the suffering? So like an understanding of the concept of wisdom and compassion, but how does one actually turn towards suffering? That's a good question. I have to, I'm so used to it now that I have to think about how one does it. Well, I think, you know, the first thing we tend to do is to find ways to avoid suffering. You know, there is suffering. Suffering arises. You know, that's just how it is. And then we find ways to avoid it. And, you know, the first thing to do is to seek either, like, sensual pleasure or intellectual pleasure, stimulation. And I think many people, you know, go through a whole lifetime doing that and get to the end of the life and have the consequences of that. I think, you know, that people, once you start on the path of practice, generally people have had some insight into the fact that there is suffering. You know, that one cannot actually, one has tried hard but hasn't managed to avoid it, hasn't managed to get away from suffering. So, you know, we have our tactics of avoidance, and they wear thin after a while, or maybe they never even work in the first place. So when that happens, then we find that we can't really avoid the suffering that is present. It's just here it is. And then we might still try and find ways to avoid it, and generally trying to find ways to avoid it increase the suffering over time. So sooner or later, if we're fortunate enough, we have to actually stop and have a look at what's going on. And it's almost like often it's when it's at a point where we can't do anything other than that. You know, we've got our nose up against it, so we don't actually have to turn towards it. It's turned towards us, and we have to just look. So that's kind of how it starts, And then, you know, with the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha is pointing us to understanding suffering. So that's like being interested in it. And I like to use the expression like standing under. You stand under it like you would under a thunderstorm, or you let yourself get wet, you know, rainstorm. So, you know, the first thing is you can't move away from it, and then because you can't move away, you know, and then there is this teaching from an enlightened being who probably knows what he's talking about. You know, there's a kind of interest of like, okay, well, what happens if I stop that movement away from this and try to be with it, try to stay present with this painful feeling? And, you know, it might be that we can only do it for a very short time, and then we go off into something else, thought, feeling, do something, eat something, watch something, whatever, drink something, you know, with it. But if we know once we know what we're doing, once we know that that is an avoidance, you know, we can't really get away with it as easily as we used to. So it's almost like it has its own momentum. And once we start to see, you know, once we start to see, then we'd kind of drawn back to look at what's going on. And then, you know, at first it might be this very ambivalent relationship where we can be with it for a while and go and do something else, doing something else. And then we're back with it again, and it's painful, and do something else. And then over time, if we trust the teaching, then we start to, you know, instead of following that movement away from to try and make it feel better or avoid it, we take an interest. It's like, well, what does it feel like? And how does it feel actually in this moment? This feeling of self-consciousness, let's say. What does that feel like? And then it's like, oh, well, it's kind of, it feels here and here, different parts, you can feel it in different parts of the body. And it's got a sort of a feeling tone. Start to notice the kind of how it is, and then it's and then as one pays attention to it in that way, it sort of loses its reality of self-consciousness. I'm self-conscious. I shouldn't be self-conscious. And it loses that, and it just becomes this direct experience of like, oh, that's interesting. it's got that vibration and it feels like that. And then you can feel like, oh, well, it doesn't always feel like that in this body and mind. Sometimes it feels quite different, you know, so it's always changing. And then when something else comes up, maybe anger, and you're really angry and you know that to act on anger is going to cause more problems, so you're not going to do that. But then you're left with this anger, you know, and that's really unpleasant. So you're with that feeling, and then you're kind of like, well, what is it like? It's like, it's got a lot of energy, it's moving, it's hot, it's got a lot of force, and then it can actually even feel quite pleasant when you're really with it. You're like, wow, you know, I feel really empowered when you're not throwing it out at other people. So it's like changing the relationship with suffering from something you want to get away from or get over or try and finish to, oh, what's this? What does it feel like? What does it look like? You know, some people have a visual mind. I tend to see, you know, visually. You feel the tone and then you can see like, oh, it's red, or sometimes it might even be white if it's really hot. You know, it's got this, it's like fire would be, you know. And it's got a certain movement, like molten movement, or, you know, fear. You know, might experience fear as a dark, like a black, contracted experience, trembling black feeling. And then it's like, because it starts to become interesting rather than a problem. And you pay attention to it and take interest in it. And when you bring your attention to those feelings, just the attention itself starts to change the experience. It starts to open up, it starts to transform just through the light of awareness, just through bringing attention to it itself. But if we bring attention in order to try and make it change, it doesn't work. It's like an attitude of interest and curiosity and investigation. And then over time you develop a strength of awareness. Your mind gets stronger. You're able to be with those feelings. Yeah. And also knowing that they're changing is a very important part of it. Knowing that this isn't always going to be like this, you know. It's a very important part. Otherwise it's very hard to be with it. When we take it as me and mine, it's very, very hard to be with it. And when it's like, you know, the way, the tides of grief, or the volcano of anger, or the whirlpool of doubt. You know, and we see them for what they are, rather than for me as me and mine. Then it also helps to stay present.
So it would seem to me that if there was really a very I was drawn to your comment earlier about how wisdom is the unchanging and the compassion is the wisdom is the steady and the compassion is the changing.
Whereas compassion is that which feels with. It's not necessarily changing, but it trembles with. It's like resonant. So it is changing.
Okay. So I got this visual picture and then I couldn't remember the words. So it seemed to me that if one really is wise about things, that then it would be easier to hold an open heart.
Mm-hmm. The heart just is open, I think, when one is really wise.
I'm sorry?
I think when one is truly wise, then the heart is open. Yeah. I mean, like really very, you know, awakened, wise. Yeah.
So like Mother Teresa.
I think Mother Teresa had a lot of suffering, actually. She had a lot of suffering.
But she had an open heart and she seemed like she was able to hold that.
Yeah, I never met her, so it's a difficult one to speak about. But I was thinking about Mother Teresa, because she had immense compassion, incredible compassion. And she served, you know, in this humble way, and she did great things for many, you know, in terms of how many people's lives she touched. And I mean, I never met her and I never spoke with her or anything, so I can't say very much. But when she died, it was interesting to see how you know, there were like how much angst she actually went through in terms of that there was, she had seems to be like doubt in God and a sense of being left, you know, where are you, and a lot of angst, you know. So it's difficult to speak about it because she's not here and I've never had a conversation with her and I don't know. But, you know, it seems that there was great compassion and then there was maybe an element of wisdom missing. Strike me down with lightning.
You know,
but I don't want to say she wasn't wise, because yeah. She was, but there was something there that she wasn't, the heart wasn't completely free. There was still this sense of it seemed like quite great troubledness, actually.
So it seems to me that the compassion, to have that much compassion, and let's not talk about her, but just in general, to have that much compassion, I can't visualize, I can't imagine having that much compassion without having an anchor of wisdom, I guess. And I don't really have a question, I guess. I'm thinking about how does one develop that stronghold of wisdom in order to be able to really have that level of, you know, a huge level of open-heartedness and compassion without bringing in suffering on it.
I haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a journey, you know, because you're thinking about it, it's got a little bit of a sense of like completion in the way you're thinking, like, how do I get there, you know? It's a journey and it's a process, so, you know, I'm not there, so I can't tell you how to get there. But what I can see is that, you know, that wisdom and compassion, that they balance each other, that they belong together. And you know, maybe over lifetimes we have to learn it, you know, but, or maybe not, but the, you know, Mother Teresa, she developed immense compassion, and, you know, it might be that she has to still work on the wisdom aspect, maybe, and she doesn't need to work on the compassion aspect anymore, and it's a process. So most of us aren't anywhere near Mother Teresa's, probably all of us would say, her, you know, openness of heart. And so, you know, coming back to how we are, it's like, it's recognizing when the heart closes down, you know, and recognizing where we get, so you can feel that, the heart closing down, and then there can also be the moving into the head and kind of having very bright, clever, righteous ideas that aren't really connected with what's going on. You know, that can be a certain, there can be incredible clarity, and it can be very right, but it isn't connected. So I think it's the connection of those two, heart and the head, really, and the understanding and the feeling, which is an ongoing process. And that we just have to keep paying attention to both of those, you know, and sometimes one is stronger, another time the other is stronger, or we may have a natural disposition towards one or the other, and then we see that and we cultivate the other side of it, you know. But I think the most useful thing is to just be able to be with this, you know, what's going on here, very honestly, and allow oneself to feel it and to know that it's changing and that that is the path that leads to the culmination of those two, you know, the being fully cultivated. Yeah. I'm not sure how useful it is to think of, you know, of Mother Teresa, for example, because she's like a great saint, you know, and we're pretty ordinary human beings, you know. So we have to start from here and look at like at this, and how to find the balance here in our own experience. And I think know that it's possible. Like the Buddha was living both.
I've been practicing only for a couple months.
Okay.
But I've noticed much less anxiety and feeling a lot more calm and noticing I'm not so interested in creating drama or being involved in drama,
good.
Which was something I did. But something interesting is other people in my life are not used to that in me and try to get me back to the way I was sort of being or thinking before. And I'm not quite sure how to... It's an interesting thing.
It is interesting.
I'm not sure what's the best way to work with that.
Well, I think probably most people experience, you know, when you start practicing, you do change quite a lot, and your values change. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't always like this, you know. So, you can lose friends. You can lose friends. There can be a period of time when you lose the friends you had, and you haven't made the new ones yet, and you become a very boring person that people, you know, they don't know what to do with anymore. And you have to kind of bear with that if it's important to you. You know, if it's like if your practice is important to you and it's what you value, then it's like your heart knows that you need to stay with that. You know, you can see that it's benefiting you, it's a good thing, and then you know, well, this is what I need to be doing. And then some people fall away from your life, and then as you keep practicing and developing your path, you find you get to know new people and people who are more resonant with what you're doing, and you find a whole new field of companionship in that way. So you do sometimes have to go through that difficult period of misfit, you know, not fitting. Yeah. Because it's in some ways it's almost like it must be for I hope you don't mind me saying it, but I think for, you know, alcoholics and drug addicts, you know, when they start coming off their whatever chosen substance, they can't fit back into the society they're in because they're not doing that anymore. And they might still really love their friends and their, you know, the people they knew, but they can't stay with them because they're not interested in that anymore. They want to get out of that. So it's a bit like that, really. You know, you can't keep on the things that were fun and exciting and entertaining. They get in the way now. They're kind of a bit of pointless, and so you just naturally move away from that. And you can still love the people, you know, but you can't necessarily meet them in that place anymore. But just to trust the process, really. And you know, I was very surprised when I sort of started practicing more. I came to the monastery just 2 years after I started meditating, so I hadn't been meditating very long. I was interested in Dharma, but I didn't learn to meditate until later. And I was very surprised at the people who fell away and the people who stayed with me, actually. They were quite unexpected. Not at all what I would have thought. So the people I thought would be interested and supportive and totally cut off, and people who I thought would have not at all be able to relate to it stayed in contact. So it's kind of like you find out who your real friends are, you know. If you go into that, because what you're doing is good for yourself, you're benefiting yourself, and you know you know that that's the right thing to do. And then there are those who maybe just wanted you for entertainment and for fun and for a laugh or whatever, for a drama, because it was exciting. And you know, then it's not exciting anymore. So, and then there'll be others who really love you, and they'll stay with you. It is, you know, you're just starting on the path, you know, it's a few months into the practice, but it is, it's an interesting path, because once you start, once you get to a certain point, you can't turn back. And I certainly remember times when I wished I could, you know, oh, If only I could turn back, you know. Because you realize that you've got to keep leaving things behind and moving on. But at the same time, it's not like you become more and more poor. It's almost like you get richer. Your life gets richer and richer, but in a true way. Yeah. So I really wish you well in your path, in your practice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, I actually wasn't keeping an eye on the time, so we've gone over time, I'm very sorry.